The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk.
Now, we spoke to my next guest last year about the rising levels of cocaine production in Colombia. The amount of land in Colombia being used to harvest coca, the plant used to make cocaine, is still at a record high. The US is the main destination for the drug. It's been pressuring Colombia to crack down on cocaine production since 2017, when the area taken up by coca plantations hit its highest ever recorded space, and that was 422,000 acres. He's now written a new book called Kilo, Life and Death Inside the Secret World of the Cocaine Cartels. And to tell us about his dangerous journey to uncover what's happening inside this industry is Toby Muse. Toby, good morning and welcome.
Good morning. Thank you for having me back on. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Now, we anticipated your book during our last conversation, but now it is available. And I started to read it yesterday. And I have to say, I was horrified and also awestruck by your bravery in embarking on your project.
Well, thank you. I'm glad you're enjoying the book. And unfortunately, it's as timely as ever. There is even more cocaine out there at the moment. Colombia continues to produce record amounts of cocaine. No one's ever seen amounts of cocaine like we're seeing now. Not even in the years of Pablo Escobar was as much cocaine being produced. And so on one level, I think, you know, the world can look at Colombia and say that Colombia is failing in this drug effort. But I think Colombia can speak back to the world and say, what is the world doing about demand? What country is seriously tackling demand? And so far, we're really not seeing it. So we're seeing record seizures across the world. In the United States, in one operation alone, last year, they seized 20 tons of cocaine. The UK is seizing more cocaine than ever, Germany as well. So it's this kind of plague across the world of all of this cocaine.
You begin the book, and this is a classic example of the law of unintended consequences. This is the peace agreement between FARC and other militias with the government. Took a long time to negotiate, and the idea was that the government would then move in, encourage the farmers to grow cacao instead of coca, and would get the farmers a good price for their produce, or coffee, even better again, because Colombian coffee is famous the world over. But instead, we have more cocaine than ever.
Indeed, it's this tragedy. It's the so you had this peace process, as you say, in 2016 between the FARC, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, the longest running insurgency in the world. By the time that they're sitting down to negotiate with the Colombian government, the FARC control much of the coca crops. It's their territory where they're strongest, where the coca is grown. Now, I should be clear, these are the remotest parts of Colombia. If a tourist who's going to Colombia, and when this coronavirus is over, I hope many tourists do go to Colombia. It's a beautiful country. There's so much to see and do there. The parts of Colombia I'm writing about, you don't get there by accident. If you're a tourist in Bogota, you are not going to end up in a field of coca. These are remote jungle places high up in the mountains. And so what happened was the FARC and the government, the FARC basically said, look at all of this coca in our territory. You must send police and army and take over this land. Bring in just the minimum of basic law and order. These are lawless lands. Bring in minimum healthcare, minimum education for the farmers who live here. And the FARC then lowered their guns. Unfortunately, the government dropped the ball. It didn't get there soon enough, and new narco militias grew up to take control of this business of the coca crops. And so that led to this record amounts of cocaine we're seeing.
Now, you look at the whole production process from the people who are stripping the leaves of the coca plant and doing it all day for what to our minds would be very low wages. But given that many of them are Venezuelan, because the economy in Venezuela is a basket case, they're making more money than they could possibly make in Venezuela, pitiful though it might be to our eyes.
Absolutely. It's a real indictment of just the massive mismanagement, corruption of the Venezuelan of the Venezuelan state over the last decade in particular, but there's also the added aspect now of US sanctions on Venezuela. So what we've seen is Colombia obviously is the neighbor of Venezuela. We have seen millions of Venezuelans literally walk out of Venezuela in search of a new life. And the region where I was in, the beginning of the cocaine trade, the coca fields, it's right next to the border with Venezuela. So a job that would have been done by young Colombian small farmers, day laborers, even 5-10 years ago, now is almost entirely done by these Venezuelans who have come looking for, just to make the minimum, I can't, it's $2.50 they make for each 11 kilos of coca leaves they collect. And so the woman I was with, I followed during a day, she made about $15 just doing this, but she was happy with that. That's the only work there is around. And I think this is the reason why cocaine and why coca is grown, because the farmers see no alternative. There's no infrastructure in these parts of the country. And when I talk about infrastructure, I mean just decent roads and bridges. So if you have a crop like pineapples, well, you would need to grow a ton of pineapples. It would cost you so much money to transport these pineapples along these dirt tracks, hours and hours. You would finally get them to market town, and the market on market day, they may simply tell you, sorry, pineapples are selling for this price below cost. You would have to sell them. Coca, everybody always wants to buy coca. The farmers know they have a guaranteed product that they can sell.
The funny thing is, the world has, you know, moved on from the earlier days of Pablo Escobar, but the farmers are not making any more money per ton of their crop than they were in the days of Pablo Escobar.
Indeed. And in fact, this could actually be something that could be very interesting if a bold, adventurous government could take advantage of this. Essentially, what happened about 15 years ago, previously, these narco militias would kind of come into the zone and they would buy and would from the coca farmers what they were selling. But in recent years, what's happened is these narco militias have demanded that the farmers sell directly to them. And they've kept the price stable for the last 15 years. Now, it's about $300 to $400 for a kilo of what we call coca paste, which is having turned these leaves into this material that's one stop short of pure cocaine. And for 15 years, so the farmer is looking at all of his other costs have been going up, obviously, for inflation over the past 15 years. But the price he receives has stayed the same. So for the first time in my life, every coca farmer I spoke to, every person involved in this part of the trade told me they want to get out. They just want to hear the government come with a real proposal to help them get out. But all of them were sick of being in the business. They said there's, for all of the downside of this business, which is once you get into the cocaine world, that means you're constantly dealing with these narco militias. It's a world of violence and bloodshed. And these farmers said, we want to get out of there, but we just don't have alternatives. We want the government to help us to get out of this.
And then some of the wealthier people coming in and wanting to buy the land for the production of cocaine, and the line, which I found very chilling, sell us your land at a below cost or a bargain basement price. Sell us your land or we'll buy it from your widow.
Indeed. And that became this kind of chilling, almost cliche in the conflict. And it was often employed by the far right paramilitaries. These were far right death squads who had been set up, who were drug traffickers themselves, who were setting up to fight these Marxist-Leninist guerrilla groups. Colombia's conflict is so confusing with so many different rebel groups. Just to give you an example, where I was in this one region called Catatumbo, there is the EPL, which is a Maoist organization. There is the ELN, which was a group of leftists inspired by the Cuban Revolution. There's the dissidents of the FARC. And then there's another group called the AGC. So it's hard to keep track of all of these different groups. But the far-right paramilitaries often working with local politicians in much of the north of the country went on this massive expansion, just taking all of this land, and just to kind of put a veneer of legal respectability, they would insist that the owner of the land sign over the papers. And as you say, that was always the offer. We do the deal now or we'll buy from your widow.
Now, you follow the trade from the harvesting of the crop and people lugging these the produce of their labor at the end of the day, it being weighed and all of that. Then you go into the labs and see the use of gasoline to get to this coca paste point. And then, of course, those who sell it make some money and they end up in this town called, is it Lagabara?
Which
I mean, what an extraordinary place, a dangerous place where, you know, death, prostitution, drugs, anything goes.
It really does. And it's the scene that's replicated across the country in these coca zones where the coca is grown. They need these kind of hubs, these coca towns where the farmers will come in from the countryside on market day to sell their product. The best way of explaining it is if you've seen these old westerns, these old cowboy movies, or that HBO series called Deadwood, if you've seen any of this, then you're starting to get an idea of what these towns are like. It's a gold rush mentality. There's no law. I mean, the police are there in theory, but the real law, you know, are these narco militias who are operating and watching everybody from the shadows. It's this wild night where the farmers come in, and he's been given just a block of cash in to sell his kilo of coca paste. He would get about $1.4 million, which it's good money in the Colombian countryside. So what happens is it's this nihilism of coca where the farmers just go out and they spend their money on the beer, they spend their money on prostitutes, and it just all comes together in this kind of weird, dark weekend of partying. And then the farmer, hung over and having spent a lot of that money, will go home, and there's an old joke that he turns up with he goes back home with a few coins in his pocket and a sad story. That's all he's got left over from this weekend in this wild town.
And you met one of the girls who was applying her trade as a prostitute. Her mother thought she worked in a cafe. She didn't want to do it, but didn't see any other recourse because she had a 2-year-old at home.
Indeed, it's these heartbreaking stories that are coming out of Venezuela. When you speak to these Venezuelans, just the hardship that they've gone through, and we're talking about literally people who are starving, who are going to bed hungry, and these were the stories you hear about that back in Venezuela, they weren't eating enough. And so she had been there working, but she couldn't handle being in La Guevara anymore because because there's three different narco militias fighting for control of this small town, it's a constant aura, an environment of just violence. There's a shootout could appear any time. She told me that when the shootouts begin on the streets, she just jumps under her bed. She hasn't grown up in this. She was learning this the fast way. She had arrived with some friends. Some of her other friends just couldn't handle it. But she went on to tell me that she thought we were living in the end time. She talked about that this must be the apocalypse, that she just thought there was so much evil in the world that this was the end of the world. It was heartbreaking. And by the end of our conversation, you know, this often happens in these interviews out in the field. It becomes almost like therapy. And by the end of this conversation, she had made this decision. She was no longer going to stay in La Guevara. She told me, I'm going to move to Bogota. I don't care what it takes. I can't live here any longer. Unfortunately, I was never able to kind of keep in contact with her to see if she made it or not.
Now, I want to read a little piece. In front of the Virgin Mary, the killer kneels. The Virgin looks down on him with a mother's unquestioning love. A bow of the head, eyes squeezed tight, he mutters the assassin's prayer. If there are eyes, don't let them see me. If there are hands, don't let them grab me. If there are feet, don't let them catch up to me. Don't let me be surprised from behind. Don't let my death be violent. Don't let my blood spill. You who see all know well my sins, but also you know my faith. Don't abandon me. Amen. That's an extraordinary scene of an assassin, you know, wanting a blessing from the Virgin for his dirty work.
Indeed. And this is really why I wanted to write this book. I wanted to kind of show this deep, dark, weird eccentricities of the drug world. And that was one of them, that these sicarios, that these contract killers, these killers for hire, will go and pray for success in upcoming missions. This was an assassin I interviewed called Cachote. That was his nickname he gave me. And yeah, that's what they'll do. And so the first question you ask is, wait, if you are a believer and you are an assassin, there's a contradiction there. How can you do that? How can you believe in the life after death and still be committing crimes, such horrendous crimes in this life? And it became this fascinating, almost just bizarre philosophical conversation with him. He said, well, and again, it's this constant evasion of responsibility in cocaine. So he said, when I go out on a mission, if I'm successful, that means God wanted me to be successful. God's all powerful. That means that that person who has done nothing to me must have sinned against someone else. So I am just there to avenge that previous sin. And if I am not successful, if I'm not able to kill the person I've been paid to do so, that means God is stepping in to save that person, i.e. that person is innocent. So it becomes quickly very strange and very weird, but it also just shows how, unfortunately, it shows how becoming a killer for hire is a profession, and that is because of this cartel system that is infused in so many of these slums, where these young men, mainly men, occasionally women, but young men, grow up with a feeling of utter hopelessness. They just feel to be anybody in this life or to get any sort of stable work is just, they can't even imagine it. So it becomes tempting, these types of jobs. They can be easily manipulated. And that's another part that you constantly hear about these contract killers, that older men get to them when they're in their teenage years.
Nobody trusts anybody. I mean, if there's one thing that emerges from your book, is that it doesn't end well for a lot of these people who are participants in the drug trade. And there's a kind of an acceptance that it won't end well, that their death will probably be violent. And the other parallel is the amount of corruption that is endemic in the system.
Indeed, I think that is, if anything, the culture of cocaine. It's this idea of party today, get all of the riches, all of the luxuries, all of the women you ever dreamt of, and live life at 200 miles an hour, because you could die at your 30, could die at 40. At one point, I describe it, it's like to be at the center of the drugs trade, it can feel like you're standing in the middle of the casino and everybody all around you is just winning money. There's that electricity in the air. Everybody is kind of giddy with all of the money that's passing through their hands. But at any moment, someone could step up next to you and put a bullet in your head. That's what being at the center of cocaine feels like. And many people are happy to accept that deal. They say, I'll have 20 great years and that's it. You know, because again, but that's a decision that's made when your life has been scarred by violence. Colombia has gone through this tremendous decades of violence. Now, the violence has definitely gone down in the last 15 years or so. But many of these men and women grew up in tremendous violence was just commonplace. It was normal. And I think that kind of that distortion is often a result of that.
Finally, I suppose the job of eradicating it. I mean, they have the crews called the eradicators who go out to try and destroy the crops. And, you know, they put their lives on the line as well. I presume they do it because there's an income, a living to be made from it. But the United States still putting pressure on the Colombians to destroy the crops. They were using Roundup or an equivalent of Roundup. But of course, that's carcinogenic. And there are many lawsuits in the United States about the use of these carcinogens. You know, what are they doing with this kind of technique to the whole environment of the rainforest?
Well, as you say, the manual eradicators have been there. They've been ripping out the crops. Basically, the police with these day laborers turn up and it's a 3-month mission. They go into the deepest parts of the jungle where they know coca is, and they camp there and just move slowly through the zone, physically ripping out the coca crops. But as you say, these narco militias, they know it's extremely dangerous work because the narco militias leave these IEDs throughout the coca crops. And it's kind of this philosophy of, if you're going to take my coca, I'm going to make you bleed. The US government does want the Colombian government to return to aerial fumigation. I think because it says that's the most effective way. But really, even if the Colombia is to return to aerial fumigation, the reason why these farmers keep going back, what happens is they will fly over, they will fumigate the crops, but then the farmer will be plunged into poverty. What's the quickest way to get out of poverty? To plant some more coca. So it's not really resolving the underlying problems, which is these farmers growing up in poverty and without really alternatives, stable alternatives, the way coffee used to be at some point. If they don't have those alternatives, they're just going to keep growing coca. And we've seen that already. There needs to be a much more comprehensive plan, especially focused on working with the farmers rather than against them. I think that's the only solution. And if that was to happen, I think we would feel it instantly in a decrease in cocaine in Ireland, the UK, America, Europe. It's a worldwide problem. And I think the world needs to work with Colombia on this. This is not Colombia's problem alone. We're all responsible for this, I would say.
Well, the book is absolutely brilliant. It's called Kilo: Life and Death Inside the Secret World of the Cocaine Cartels. I'm sure you can buy it online at the moment for delivery to your home or a delivery to a Kindle or whatever. It's priced around €16. And its author, based in Colombia, Toby Muse, thank you very, very much for joining us on the programme today.
Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you very much, Toby.